Senators and representatives, I have the distinguished honor of presenting the President of the United States.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker, members of the Senate and of the House of Representatives, yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific.
It is Friday, December 7th, 2012. My name is Ben Stone, and welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast, where liberty is our mission. I want to make one thing perfectly clear. This is in a series. This is the fourth in a series I'm doing on war. There may be several more to come. I'm not really sure. Let's see how this one goes, and we'll decide on that. I'm pretty sure I'm going to do one more in this series on the beginning of World War One, and then I'm hoping to have a historian on the podcast to talk about the Christmas truce of World War One. And so I'm hoping to have that before December 25th, and so those two will probably be included in this series as all together as a series on war. But today I want to focus on December 7th, 1941, the attack on Pearl Harbor, and why you've been lied to about that, and exactly what it is that took place. Now, of course, we only have 1 hour here to talk about this. This is a topic that volumes have been written about. So I'm going to have to just go kind of fast and breeze through these things. And I'm going to have to just ask you that if you don't believe what I'm saying, check out my references, read the books that I'm talking about, and then decide for yourself what you think. And I do want to mention two books specifically that I'm depending upon. There is one of my favorite books. It's A Century of War, Lincoln, Wilson, and Roosevelt by John Denson. And John Denson really lays the argument out. And what he doesn't say for himself, he gives references, and you can search it and find supporting material from the references that he gives. The other book is The Pearl Harbor Myth, Rethinking the Unthinkable by George Victor. Now, I need to make it clear, George Victor is very much pro Roosevelt. Okay, so he is making an apology or an apologetic for Roosevelt's lying and bringing the United States into war by using the myth of the Pearl Harbor attack. Of course, the Pearl Harbor attack actually took place. I don't mean it that way. Now, and there's something else I should say about this. There were a lot of people deceived. There were a lot of soldiers, sailors, Marines that died on during the attack at Pearl Harbor, and that died because of all this that went on. And what I'm saying does not in any way reflect on my feelings in regards to the sacrifices that they made. What I am strictly dealing with here is the President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, his deceptions in order to make excuses. Well, first off, to ensure that he got himself reelected by acting like a peace president, and then doing everything he could do, everything within his power, to become a war president. That's what I'm talking about. So anything that I'm saying should not be taken as a reflection, as a negative reflection in any way on any soldier, sailor, or airman. But everything I'm saying should be taken as a direct attack on Franklin Roosevelt and those apologists who have allowed this lie to continue. Now, one thing I should point out about World War II, a lot of people think, well, you know, the tremendous sacrifice that the Marines and the sailors and the airmen and the Army, this tremendous sacrifice that they made, and it was so horrible and everything, and all that's true. I'm not taking away from any of that. But keep in mind also that 70% of the deaths in World War II were civilian deaths. From firebombing cities, from, Holocaust, from all the horrible destruction that took place, 70% of the deaths in World War II were civilian deaths. And World War II, you know, you can look at it in a variety of different ways, but World War II had to happen. And the reason it had to happen was because World War I had already happened. World War I set the stage for a century of civilian deaths and unneeded war. And yes, it is unneeded. World War II was unneeded, even though it was destined to happen. You couldn't get away from it. The way World War I ended, there's no possible way you could not have a World War II to finish it off. But World War I was entirely unnecessary, and I'll get into that. If I do the rest of the series and continue on World War I, I'll get into that. But you have to understand that once World War I, once the United States specifically got involved in World War I, World War II was almost guaranteed. And if there was any question about it, the signing of the Treaty of Versailles, that it locked it in. The Treaty of Versailles was so terrible. It's the one thing that Austrian economists can agree with John Maynard Keynes about. He called it Carthaginian in its scope. He was referring to the way that Rome had dealt with Carthage after the Carthaginian wars had been fought. So, you know, it's the one thing that Austrians can agree with Keynes about. It was just a horrible, horrible thing. And it guaranteed that there would be, a continuation of that war, of World War I. And most people who've actually taken the time and studied the treaty, they'll pretty much agree. I mean, this is not a radical statement. There's pretty even agreement that the Treaty of Versailles absolutely set the stage, and World War II could not have been avoided because of that. But, you know, that doesn't give Roosevelt, that doesn't give him an excuse to lie to the American people and deceive them. And I'll get into that in a minute. Here's a gem you may not know about. Article 156 of the Treaty of Versailles transferred Germany's holdings in Shandong, China, to Japan, rather than returning them returning the region to China. This is really interesting. It's one of many acts by the Western powers that boosted Japan over China and over Russia, and kind of set Japan up for, you know, for everything that happened after that. Shandong is a chunk of mainland China about the size of the U.S. state of Oregon. Germany had finagled control of Shandong in 1897. When the Chinese tried to take it back from Germany, American Marines were used during the Boxer Rebellion to beat back the weakened Chinese into submission to the West. And then it was handed to Japan after World War I. Very odd. And then also on this same storyline, in 1922, the U.S. government stepped in negotiations between China and Japan, and at the Washington Naval Conference, and Shandong reverted to Chinese control at that time. And so this may sound like the U.S. was opposing Japan or putting something in their way or whatever, but actually, because of the Washington Naval Conference, Japan ended up grabbing huge chunks of China and Mongolia over this. Overall, the conflict over Shandong and the Washington Naval Conference, a lot of experts agree that that helped drive Imperial Japan towards the collision course with the U.S. government. Now, again, that was in 1922, long before Roosevelt had any influence on it. So we think about Pearl Harbor in December 7th of 1941, and it's really easy just to, you know, just to turn the switch on at that point and not think of anything prior to that and you know, just go forward from there. Hey, somebody punched us in the nose. We've got to go get them back. That kind of a mentality. But a clear-thinking person has to go beyond that. You have to realize, you know, I said in the other podcasts on war, wars don't just pop out of nowhere. Now, they seem to the people who are not paying attention, who don't, you know, follow along in politics and aren't following along in foreign policy and don't know all the finagling and the ins and outs. It seems like war just pops up out of nowhere. There's always this dramatic excuse. Oh, we have to do something now. There's no time to think about it. No more time for talking. Now's the time for action. We have to jump right in. That's how war is always portrayed by the government that wants war. But if you look beyond that myth, and you look beyond December 7th of 1941, and you look at all the things that set the stage for that day, then you begin to get a little bit bigger picture picture of the event. Prior to December 7th, Roosevelt had been playing games with the Japanese dignitaries. He would do stuff like, because they were trying to talk to him and negotiate and so forth like this. And so he would cancel appointments with them or just leave them sitting, you know, sitting out in an office by themselves for hours at a time when they were supposed to be meeting with him. He did all kinds of little shenanigans like that to embarrass and humiliate them. In the process of all this, Roosevelt cut off the steel trade to Japan. Then he cut off the fuel oil and gasoline trades to Japan. And then he cut off machine oil to Japan. And this is what I'm saying here is he forbid U.S. corporations from trading these items with Japan. And then he cut off all machine oils, and then he cut off rubber goods, and then he cut off all petroleum products. Now, the whole time, the Japanese were attempting to negotiate with Roosevelt, and he was doing these tricks with them. He was embarrassing them, leaving them sitting in an office by themselves, canceling appointments with them. He had plenty of time for photo ops and for going down to the spa and relaxing in his favorite, in his favorite hot springs. He had plenty of time for that. But when it came time to talking to the Japanese dignitaries about, about this problem and this buildup that was taking place, he didn't have time to speak with them personally about that. He would put underlings talking to them instead of dealing with them himself. So before we get into that, I want to read an entry from the diary of Secretary of War Henry Stimson concerning a meeting with President Roosevelt in his cabinet that took place November 25th, 1941, 12 days before the attack on Pearl Harbor. So I'm going to read from his diary. Stimson writes, the question was how we would maneuver them into a position of firing the first shot without allowing too much damage to ourselves. That's Stimson's words in his diary. I'm going to read it again. The question was how we should maneuver them into a position of firing the first shot without allowing too much danger to ourselves. Allowing too much danger to ourselves. At Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, 8 U.S. naval battleships were damaged, of which 6 were repaired and returned to service. The Japanese sank or damaged 3 cruisers, 3 destroyers, 1 anti-aircraft training ship, and 1 mine layer. Also, 188 U.S. aircraft were destroyed that morning. But the real number that you get from Pearl Harbor is that 2,402 Americans were killed, and an additional 1,282 were wounded. Evidently, a few thousand American lives destroyed that wasn't too much danger for Roosevelt and his cabinet. They were safely away from the battle there in Washington, D.C., without allowing too much danger to ourselves. Yeah, a few thousand American lives, that's perfectly okay. That's an acceptable thing, right? It's perfectly acceptable. You say, well, they didn't know. Yes, they did know. They intentionally moved those people there. They intentionally left them there unguarded, and they knew the fleet was on its way to attack, and they intentionally held back the orders to do something about it. They went so far, and this is very famously known, they went so far The order came down to huddle all the airplanes together because there might be a saboteur that might come up and try to get into the airport and blow them up. Because normally you spread planes out in jagged patterns so that if a plane comes down to try to attack them from the air, it can't just shoot one right after the other. They're in random patterns so that they're hard to hit. But the order came down to move all the planes together. And this happened right before the December 7th attack. All the ammo boxes for the anti-aircraft batteries that protected Pearl Harbor were locked, and the keys were separate from the batteries. In other words, the guys who were supposed to defend Pearl Harbor with anti-aircraft guns couldn't do so because the ammunition was all locked away. And I'm not going to get into all the details of stuff like that, but there was a bunch of things like that that show that that Pearl Harbor was completely unready to be attacked, and yet the people in Washington, D.C. knew that it was going to happen, including Roosevelt, without allowing too much danger to ourselves. So, really and truly, now other than the tragedy of human loss, what was really lost at Pearl Harbor? Well, the eight, you know, most of those ships, the cruisers, three destroyers, anti-aircraft training ship, most of that was not really all that important. There were eight battleships. But here's the thing about the eight battleships. They were all old, outdated relics left over from before World War I. Here's the list. Arizona was sunk. Everybody knows that's still there. It was outright loss of life. It was horrible. The Oklahoma was sunk, and later it was stripped and sold to scrap metal. The Nevada was seriously damaged, but was eventually repaired. The Tennessee suffered relatively minor damage and was back in the war within 2 months. The California was sunk. It was refloated and repaired by January. The Maryland was damaged and was repaired within about 2 months. And the Pennsylvania was damaged and repaired within 3 months and back into the war. So the actual damage of World War II, when looked at by these slime in Washington, D.C., when the actual damage was really just, the loss of two old, outdated battleships, and then the others just had to be fixed back up. But those battleships were not really, like I said, they were, for instance, the Oklahoma and the Nevada were the first two warships to be fired by oil rather than coal-fired steam engines. Every one of those ships ended up being more like support ships, the ones that were rebuilt and put back into action. They ended up more in a role of like support ships because none of them were suitable for direct confrontation with Japan's modern fleet. Think of it this way. The USS Arizona, which was sunk, its top speed that it had ever achieved at any time, its record speed was 21 knots. But the modern USS Chicago could cruise at 32 knots. So the Arizona literally could not keep up with an ocean-going task fleet. So I'll tell you what, I'm going to break for the commercial. When I come back, I'll talk a little bit more about this. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break there. So now a lot of people in Washington, D.C., a lot of military people around the world knew that World War II was not going to be a battleship war. The age of battleships was over. This was well established. The carrier task group was the center of modern naval warfare by 1940. The old-style battleships were basically floating scrap metal even before Pearl Harbor, before the attack on Pearl Harbor took place. A lot of people in Washington knew this. A lot of people at the Pentagon knew this. Here's a story that you may not know. Under cover of darkness, on the night of November 11th, 1940, a full year before the attack on Pearl Harbor, the British committed a sneak attack using torpedo bombers, and they destroyed the Italian fleet at Taranto, Italy. During that attack, the British lost two airplanes, and they wiped out the Italian fleet. So the battleship itself And those were, you know, those were battleships because the battleship itself was a relic from the last century. Once you have air capabilities, the battleship is helpless. It's a useless thing as far as that type of battle goes. By 1930, everybody that really understood modern naval warfare really understood that the battleship was just a big chunk of money that wasn't available for war, that wasn't available to the Navy for anything else. Just look at it as all this money sitting there, and you can't do anything with it. So it's a liability. So every single one of the old-style battleships was nothing but a liability to the U.S. Navy. They literally would have preferred not to have any of them. So then if the battleships, most of which were not lost, but the two that were actually lost, if the battleships were not that big of a deal, and if the losses other than the horrific loss of human life, if the losses at Pearl Harbor really weren't all that bad, well then what really, what was not lost at Pearl Harbor? It might be, you know, if you think about what was lost, and again, we set aside the terrible loss of life, and we think what was really lost at Pearl Harbor. But don't think that way. Think to yourself, what was not lost at Pearl Harbor? Well, what was not lost, in a way, in a very real way, was more important than what was lost. What was not lost was the carriers. All of the carrier task forces were safely at sea on maneuvers or other assignments. Very conveniently, the carriers had been at Pearl, but were moved just days before the attack. You remember what that guy said? Let me look up in my notes here. Without allowing too much danger to ourselves. Yeah. See, it's perfectly fine to these people. It's perfectly fine to kill, to maim, to destroy the lives of a few thousand people. That's okay. That's, you know, that's the cost of war, they say. That's how it's done. It's okay. You know what? All those women back home, they'll pop out more babies. It's no problem. Go ahead and let them die. Go ahead and kill them. Go ahead and let those soldiers die. Go ahead and let those sailors die. That's perfectly fine. What's really important is that we protect the carriers. We wouldn't want to lose the carriers, you see. So all the carrier task forces were safely out at sea. As a general rule, a carrier task force is made up of four separate carrier task groups. Each group would have been made up of two to four carriers and then supported by destroyers, cruisers, and the newly built fast battleships that were designed to support carrier warfare. So there's this idea, and I've read it over and over, and I've heard people say it, that Japan devastated the Pacific Fleet. No, they didn't. That's an absolute lie. Japan did not devastate the Pacific Fleet. The Pacific Fleet was safe and was never touched at Pearl Harbor. What was touched at Pearl Harbor was bait. It was throwaway. All those lives were bait. To Washington, D.C., and to the people that ran the war, those lives were throwaway. Now, let me talk about the buildup just a bit. Let me talk about how Roosevelt baited this trap. On May 7th of 1940, the U.S. fleet that had been safely headquartered at San Pedro, California, was moved to Pearl Harbor. Now, this move was opposed by Admiral James Richardson, the commander-in-chief of the U.S. fleet. Richardson and most Navy officers opposed the move because they felt that having the fleet anchored in this bottlenecked, shallow Pearl Harbor would be dangerously exposing it to the Japanese naval strength. Many felt that it would be seen as an act of aggression on the part of the U.S. Now, I'd like for you to do something. As a matter of fact, I'm going to have you do this a couple times during this podcast. If you can at all, either now or later on when you can think about it, pull up a Google map and look at the harbor at Pearl Harbor. Just take a look at it for yourself and realize that the entire harbor, it comes into one little bottleneck, and that one bottleneck could be closed off by sinking a single battleship in the neck of that harbor. You could close the entire harbor by dropping one battleship in the neck of that harbor. And that's exactly what the Japanese tried to do. The Nevada narrowly escaped being that plug to stop up the harbor. But, you know, they valiantly moved the Nevada out of the way and were able to get it out of the out of that neck. Pearl Harbor is a horrible place to put the fleet. It's hard to maneuver in and out of. It's very shallow, and you have to really be careful as you're moving around in there. So then, why would they do that? Why would Roosevelt take the fleet where it was safe in San Pedro? I mean, of all places, it was good and safe there, and stick it way out in the middle of the Pacific, unprotected, in a bottlenecked, shallow harbor? Why would he do that? Well, he did it. In 1940, he did that in May of 1940, okay? In 1941, Roosevelt seized the airports on Midway Atoll and Wake Island from Pan American Airways. And in January 1941, the United States Navy began construction of a military base on Wake Island, roughly halfway between Japan and Hawaii. If you're not sure about this, again, take a look at a map of the Pacific Ocean. Look at where California's at. San Pedro Harbor is down in Southern California. And then look at where Pearl Harbor is in Japan. And then look at where Pearl Harbor is in Hawaii. And then look at where Japan is. And you'll see that what you have is you have exposed the fleet to a direct strike from Japan. But then pick out in that map two places. As you look at Hawaii and as you look at Japan, to the north you're going to see Midway Island, and to the south you're going to see Wake Island or Atoll. They're both actually atolls. But anyway, so Roosevelt seizes the airports on Midway and Wake and begins construction of military bases there. Now, how could Japan look at this as anything other than a direct act of aggression? Here we go, after all this time frame, within this little window of time that Roosevelt begins all this cutting Japan off from different goods and cutting them off from trade and refusing to meet with their delegates and all the way that he was treating them, at the same time, he's moving his entire Pacific fleet right down Japan's throat. And he's putting military bases in literally a hop-skip fashion between Hawaii and Japan. Now, were they dumb? Could they not see that? Of course they saw it. Of course they knew the threat. In August of 1941, Roosevelt moved elements of the 1st Marine Defense Battalion onto Midway Island. Oh, I'm sorry. He moved those onto Wake Island. But about the same time, he did pretty much the same thing with Midway. But it wasn't exactly on August 19th. Now, also in 1941, in March of 1941, the Lend-Lease Act was signed. And you know, a lot of people, on both sides of this argument, a lot of people have said that the Lend-Lease Act effectively ended the United States' pretense of neutrality. And you know, if we think about what was talked about in justifying the War of 1812 and the things about supplying Napoleon and all this kind of stuff, essentially, if you apply the same rules, then, yeah, again, you know, the Lend-Lease Act was essentially an act of war against Germany and Japan. Now, there's another funny thing about all this. I was talking about the U.S., specifically about Roosevelt, moving the entire fleet to Hawaii and then fortifying Wake Island and Midway Island. And to Japan, this had to have looked like an act of aggression, especially considering that Roosevelt was cutting them off diplomatically. He was cutting them off in trade. Actually, even he went so far as to seize Japanese bank holdings in the U.S. He did this before December 7th, 1941. He actually seized Japanese bank holdings in the U.S. Now, if that's not clearly to the Japanese, if that's clearly not an indication that he's getting ready to attack you, then what kind of indication would you need? People today, you know, who look at this and they justify first strikes. They justify the United States making first strikes on people. Like the United States made a first strike on Iraq. The list goes on and on and on of modern day United States aggressions where the United States had made the first act of aggression. And these same people, they justify the U.S.'s first strikes, but they condemn Japan for its first strike at Pearl Harbor. The U.S. Was a greater threat to Japan in 1941 than any country has ever been to the U.S. Keep in mind, Japan depended on the U.S. almost entirely prior to about 1940. Japan relied on the U.S. almost entirely for its oil and rubber goods, oil trade, fuel, steel. All these things were supplied to Japan by the U.S. And now all of a sudden, the U.S. cuts them off, and it looks like the U.S. is going to just come in and crush Japan. And why would the Japanese not believe that that's exactly what the U.S. was going to do? So why should they hold back? If you know, if you got a guy coming at you, and he's got it in his eyes, and you can see it, that he's just going to beat you to death, and you know he has the capability of doing it, and all of his motions and all of his actions are in every way telegraphing to you that he is going to come after you and he is going to do some serious damage to you, then if you don't, at some point, when he gets within arm reach, if you don't do something to pop him in the nose or whatever, then you're going to take a terrible beating. Well, do you just stand there and let him thump you? Is that what you do? Well, that's the way Japan looked at it. And there were even statements that Japanese delegates made that said, basically to the effect of, this is going to be suicide to attack the U.S., but we're going to die anyway if we don't. The empire is dead if we don't do this. If we can punch America hard enough and then try to negotiate a peace with them, we might have a chance. But if we don't do this, they're going to crush us. Now, and we know that these, and as a matter of fact, Roosevelt even intercepted those messages and had read them. And this is all before December 7th, 1941. So now, let's get to the lies used to justify the war. It was all about Pearl Harbor. That's what was sold to the American people. Prior to December 7th, 1941, the vast majority of the American people did not want to be involved in World War II. They did not want to make the mistake of going into another war on foreign ground to save foreign countries from foreign aggressors. The people of the U.S. had no interest in this at all. But also, they believed Roosevelt's talk of peace and his desires to stay at peace and stay neutral. They believed all that, and so they reelected him in 1940. Of course, that was all lies. But the American people were so ill-informed that they pretty much believed whatever Roosevelt said. You know, he was a voice that came on the radio, and they all huddled around it, and they listened to him, and they just believed everything that he said. Most people in the United States, well, actually, most people in the United States didn't know there was such a thing as Hawaii or Pearl Harbor. And a lot of people in the U.S. heard the words Pearl Harbor and Hawaii for the very first times after that attack. And so they didn't really understand where it was or any of the history of it. They knew nothing about the buildup that that Roosevelt had been doing to prepare for the war. They knew nothing about any of those things. It's just all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it comes all over the radio that Japan has attacked America. And, you know, people on the West Coast were terrified. They were expecting Japanese armies to land at any moment. It was just a crazy level of fear that the American people had, because they didn't know. They were so ill-informed of these things, and they just trusted what Roosevelt said to them. Most Americans had no idea that the U.S. Navy had attempted on several occasions to provoke the Germans into firing on naval ships. Most people had no idea that that was going on. Most people had no idea that Roosevelt had been actively trying to get Hitler to begin the war with the U.S., and only when Roosevelt failed to provoke Hitler, then he went after Japan, and he went after them very aggressively. There's a historian named Thomas Bailey. He's a professor at Stanford University, and he's a real strong Roosevelt apologist. He said back in 1948, he wrote a book called The Man in the Street, and this is what he said in his book. He said, Franklin Roosevelt repeatedly deceived the American people during the period before Pearl Harbor. Then he says, if he was going to induce the people to move at all, he would have to trick them into acting for their best interest, or what he considered to be their best interest. He was like a physician who must tell the patient lies for the patient's own good. You see how these people think? They're perfectly comfortable lying to you so that your sons can go out and die for their pet projects. In his book, Bailey goes on to say, the country was overwhelmingly non-interventionalist to the very day of Pearl Harbor, and an overt attempt to lead the people into war would have resulted in certain failure and an almost certain ousting of Roosevelt in the 1940 election, with a consequent defeat for his ultimate aims. You see, this professor is, quote, later on in the same situation, this professor quoted Congresswoman Claire Booth Lucy, who was the wife of the media mogul Henry Lucy. And she said, Roosevelt lied us into the war because he didn't have the political courage to lead us into it. And that's exactly what he did. He pretended like he was the peace president. He pretended like, you know, oh, he's out here trying to keep war from happening. But what he was really doing the whole time was setting America up and lying to America so that when the time came, as soon as he had an excuse, he would bring war onto the American people. And this was all based on layers and layers and layers of lies. You know, the American people believed during the early years, the American people believed that America was actually at risk of an invasion. Even today, court historians lie about this point. You know, if you look at some of the sensationalism or the hype, like they have over at the History Channel or some other sources, they have History Channel did a whole thing based on sketches of imaginary aircraft and comments from minor officers about how Germany or Japan had, you know, wanted to attack the U.S. and all this kind of stuff, and it's all imaginary, and most of it comes from late in the war, like 1944, 45, and stuff like this. But they lie about it, they twist the facts, they twist things around, and they try to make it as sensational as possible to make it seem like Roosevelt was saving us from some kind of horrible invasion by the Japanese or by the Germans. And, you know, you can't really even discuss this without realizing that the race card played a part in this. Through the late 30s and then really heavy in the 40s, there was tons of propaganda about how horrible the Japanese people were, picturing them, you know, with the thick glasses and the buck teeth and real short and bent over and almost monkey-like in their appearance. It was horrible racism that was just being poured out of Hollywood and out of, you know, the U.S. government propaganda machine to make the Japanese as demonized as possible. There were newsreels in the day and cartoons between every movie showing what horrible people the Japanese were and mocking them and making fun of them as bloodthirsty savages. It was, you know, if you just go back and look at some of that stuff, it's amazing. I'm going to go ahead and break again, and when I get back, we'll try to wrap this up. Okay, thanks for sticking with me. So what were the actual reasons for war? Okay, well, you know, again, the way World War I ended, World War II was practically guaranteed. So what we're really talking about here is the lies that, you know, instead of being a man, instead of standing up and saying, look, we have these ties to England and we're kind of stuck politically, so we have to go to war for political reasons. Instead of doing any of those things, Roosevelt just decided to lie and trick Japan into attacking Pearl Harbor, and he was perfectly comfortable, you know, sacrificing thousands of lives and just destroying people's lives. The ones that survived it were maybe arguably worse off than the ones who were killed instantly, because, you know, the pain of something like that sticks with you for years and years. But evidently that was a cost that, you know, that the guys in Washington were willing to pay, right? Okay, so what really was the source of all this? Well, money and power. Money and power is always the source of war. On the power end, Roosevelt had direct ties to individuals in England. You know, Roosevelt was a money man. He was in Wall Street. He was big in all that stuff prior to running for election, and he had all kinds of both family and financial connections to people in high places in England. John Denson, in his book Century of War, he goes through and puts some of those connections into it lays out those connections, how they worked and so forth, and he has the links and everything for that. So Roosevelt, and if you really think about it, war made Roosevelt, like Wilson and Lincoln before him, an unhindered, unopposed dictator. He could do anything. He could round up people and have them, shoved into concentration camps. He could have martial law. He could have, the presses shut down. He could do anything he wanted to do because he was a virtual dictator. But, Lincoln was stopped by an assassin's bullet. Wilson was stopped by influenza and a stroke. And Roosevelt was stopped by a massive cerebral hemorrhage. To that I would say, sic semper tyrannis, perpetuus. Thus always to tyrants, forever. So again, I wouldn't want to strongly urge you to get a hold of John Denson's book and go through and read this for yourself, and you'll see how, he goes point by point with the deceptions, the lies, opposite promises made to different people, and what I was referring to, this Anglo-American group, these key connections to certain British individuals that put Roosevelt into a position where he had obligations, more obligations maybe to the British than he had to the people in the U.S. that had actually elected him. Now, in addition to that, we have the money problem. Vast wealth was dumped into things like underground bunkers, defense structures. In where I used to work, just outside of Cincinnati, Ohio, was a big aircraft engine manufacturing plant. And it was there, it was first built, it was built before the war, but then it was expanded and fortified during World War II. They put in blast-resistant underground bunkers in this aircraft engine factory in Cincinnati, Ohio, like there was any possible way ever of a German bomber flying to Cincinnati, Ohio and bombing Cincinnati. Come on. The planes, they didn't have that kind of planes. It just didn't exist at the time. Germany, had a lot of light bombers, but Germany really didn't even have any heavy bombers. So why would they spend the kind of money that they spent to build an elaborate, we called it the labyrinth, or we would call it the catacombs. It was just a huge series of fortified offices and everything underground outside of Cincinnati. Well, why would they spend the kind of money to do stuff like that? Why would they? Because people are getting paid. Because, some company with the right connections gets the contract to build all this stuff. You see? So it's all about money. If you go to the West Coast, all kinds of anti-aircraft batteries were placed around Hollywood. And it was like, oh yeah, Hollywood, that's gonna be for sure, that's gonna be one of the targets of the Japanese. Like the Japanese, had the capability of coming all the way across the ocean and attacking Hollywood? Hollywood, really? Hollywood? Yeah, but you gotta keep up the image. You gotta have, all those propaganda experts in the LA basin. You have to have them all terrified that at any time, those squinty-eyed little evil Japanese with their thick glasses and their buck teeth are going to come and get you. You see, you have to have that kind of hate and that kind of racial fear and, disgusting. So all this money had to be spent, right? And loans had to be taken out by the U.S. government and by these corporations. Well, who makes money off all those loans? Who makes money off all the money creation that took place to support this kind of vast spending? Who makes money off of that? Well, Roosevelt's friends in the banking industry, Roosevelt's friends in Wall Street, Roosevelt's friends in London. They all made a fortune. Vast fortunes were made. Well, American families were having basic staples rationed. And the same thing in England. England faced worse rationing than the U.S. did. But the U.S. had rations of meat, sugar, metal, rubber, and gasoline. Americans could not buy. You couldn't just go down and buy hamburger meat or steak or whatever. You couldn't do it. You had to have stamps from the government that allowed you so much meat per week. And people would trade these stamps back and forth and try to, get into better positions with them. You were given a certain allotment of stamps for your gas, and you could only buy certain amounts of gas. And you had to justify why you needed that gas. You had to explain whether or not you worked at a government factory, or what driving you had to take, that you had to do to get back and forth to work. You had to do all these things just to get the basics to live. And yet, at the same time, vast fortunes were being created on the back of these very families who were sending their sons out to die. So what do we really have here? We have a U.S. president that provokes a fight and then proclaims that we're already in a state of war. Wow. We talked about that already, didn't we? Isn't that what happened with Polk? Didn't Polk send troops to be slaughtered on the Mexican border, knowing that they were just a small, weak little group of troops? And he sent them to the Mexican border to be slaughtered so that he could proclaim that the U.S. had been suddenly attacked and the U.S. was in a state of war. And then we have Lincoln, who abandoned the troops at Fort Sumter, gave South Carolina no option but to open fire, lied to them, deceived them, put off the different time frames as to what he was going to do and when he was going to pull them out or whether he was going to support them, lies to South Carolina, lies to his own troops. And then once the firing starts, he proclaims that the U.S. is already in a state of war because South Carolina had fired the first shot. So Roosevelt put Japan in a position where they felt that they had no choice but to attack. And Roosevelt used thousands of American lives as bait on his trap. And then Roosevelt lied and said it was unexpected and that the negotiations were still active when the attack took place. And yet Roosevelt had been the one shutting them out of negotiations and refusing to meet with them. And Roosevelt also knew, having read the correspondence, because the United States had broken the Japanese correspondence code, the diplomatic code, long before this. So Roosevelt knew the frustration that the Japanese negotiators were facing in trying to meet with him. He knew full well when he stood before Congress and lied to them about this. And then he stood there and he said, the U.S. is already in a state of war and demands that Congress declare war. How many more times? So really and truly, World War II, of course, was the direct result of the unfinished World War I. And, you know, there was almost no way to not have a World War II. But, you know, to justify it by lying and deceiving and laying the lives of Americans out there as bait, and then lying about it, and then glorifying it, and then idolizing this monster, this president, idolizing him like this, is just disgusting. It's really disgusting. And then even today, for people to defend this monster and try to pretend like he had the best interest of the American people in mind when he laid those lives out as bait, when he pulled away the carrier fleets and moved them out of harm's way while leaving those battleships completely open like that, giving the orders to not fortify, to giving the orders to huddle all the planes up in one spot, knowing everything that he knew. And there's plenty of sources on this. This is not even something new. I knew about this stuff in high school in the 70s. I would confront my high school history teachers back then and ask questions. Well, if it was really a surprise attack, then how is it that we did this and we did this and we did this before this even took place? Why was it that we were fortifying Wake Island? Why was it that we were fortifying Midway? If the United States was completely innocent in the events of December 7th, 1941, then how do you explain these aggressive military actions of moving the fleet to Pearl Harbor, right in Japan's back door, and then this pincer movement, which that's a classic pincer movement, think of a scorpion. The scorpion has his tail that strikes, you can think of the scorpion's tail that can come and strike right in front of his eyes. And he's got his mouth right there, and he's got his vision right there, and the tail strikes right between his eyes. But then you think of the two pincers that are on each side of the scorpion, and he will use those two pincers to drive his combatant into the range of his tail, and then he strikes with his tail. And that's exactly how, that's a classic, this is how Alexander the Great fought battles. This is how it's done. You have your flanks on each side, and you drive your opponent to where you want him, and then you strike him. And this is exactly what it appeared to Japan that the U.S. was doing. Again, pull up that map. Look at where Pearl Harbor is located. Look at where Japan is located. Look at where Wake Island is located, and look at where Midway Island is located. And what you see is you see the body of a scorpion looking right at Japan with a pincer on each side and the fleet ready to strike. How could Japan sit there? How could the government of Japan sit there and do nothing? They had no choice. They saw the most powerful government in the world coming at them with the most powerful navy in the world. And they were terrified. And they knew that their empire was lost if they didn't strike. And they knew that if they did strike and were unsuccessful, their empire was lost. They knew this. And so they struck. And they took Roosevelt's bait. And Americans died. Folks, at this point, I hope I've established that the U.S. government, in conjunction with the media, select corporations, government schools, and government-approved private schools, has systematically distorted and lied about its reasons and its results to go to war. I want to thank you for listening to me today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thank you very much, folks.